We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodricks. Joining me today is Kevin Wadsworth from NorthstarBadCharts.com. How are you today, Kevin?
Hey, Tom, I'm great. Good to be here. Thanks for inviting me on again.
Excellent to have you back. And of course, you're better known as Northstar on Twitter. A lot of our listeners would know you as Northstar. So we have some excellent charts to go through today for you guys. And, you know, something that has been a theme of 2021 completely is the inflation index. You know, everybody all over the world has been seeing crazy inflation. So why don't we start by going through and looking at, you know, the historical perspective of PPI here?
Yeah, sure. I'll share my screen so that people can see what I've been looking at. And I've been posting these charts all over social media and Twitter for a while now, since before they started to break out, just in the expectation that something was about to unfold. And this is the US PPI, the Producer Price Index. And what I've done with this chart is just, it goes back over 100 years. And you can see the base that formed around about the time of the World Wars, in fact, the sort of 1914 to 18 First World War in Europe and the Second World War. And that whole period there produced the arc-shaped base pattern that you can see there on the left-hand side of the chart, the bottom left-hand side. So we had a very rapidly rising producer price index in the period 1912 to 1921, which reached peak inflation numbers of around about 23% during that period. During the 1933 to 1950 period, we also had a more steeply rising producer price index. You can see the angle that that graph goes up at, showed by the second red arrow there, is again steep. And we saw inflation figures up to at least 19% during that period as well. And then things leveled off for a while. And during the 50s and the 60s, the PPI kind of drifted sideways before accelerating upwards again as we got towards the end of the 1960s and into the 1970s. PPI went up rapidly again during that period, culminating in 1980, and inflationary numbers of at least 14% in the United States. And then it's kind of drifted sideways to sort of up, but with a much more shallow angle of ascent for a couple of two or three decades through the 1980s and 1990s and through the noughties as well, the early part of the 2000s. More recently, forming a very clear support and resistance line. Technical analysts look for support and resistance lines, and you can see that smaller black, those two smaller black lines in the period sort of 2000 and the early 2000s until just very recently. And what we were looking for was a break to the upside or to the downside. Either would have been a very significant downside break, of course, somewhat deflationary, and an upside break, very, very much inflationary. You have to remember that the PPI is the producer price index. It's the price of input costs for producers making stuff, so raw materials costs and all that kind of stuff. And they absorb those costs for a period of time. You know, there's a reluctance, I'm sure, to pass costs on to consumers to begin with. But if the move turns out to be sustained and large enough for long enough, then those input costs, those producer costs will, well, they can only end up in one place. I mean, I'm not an economist, but if it's costing more to produce stuff, then I'm afraid you have to pay more stuff, more of your hard-earned money to buy the stuff. Mm-hmm. So it ends up in the CPI. A simple way of looking at it is it's locked in inflation for the future. You know, what's been going on in the PPI is locked into what's going to happen in the CPI in the very near future.
Yeah. And the other part of this chart that I find really interesting, Kevin, is that it doesn't really ever come back down, right? So is this, could we think of this as a function of the expansion of the money supply as well? Or why do you think that it doesn't really look like a traditional chart of, you know, ups and downs?
You're quite right. I mean, the only time it sort of contracted or came down, of course, was during that period between the First and Second World War. I'm not about to try and explain why that was, because I'm not an economist, a technical chart analyst, but you're quite right to say, obviously, that since the sort of 1930s there, it's only gone in one direction, you know, very short periods of time where it's pulled back slightly. But viewed as a whole, the thing just trends relentlessly upwards. And my view on that would be, yes, you're quite right. It's the expanding money supply. There's more money around to pay for the stuff that we want to buy. So, you know, if you're increasing the currency in circulation in absolute terms, the number, you know, so it goes from a few trillion to a few tens of trillions to a few hundred trillions of dollars that are in circulation, then, you know, the price, the nominal price that you're going to pay for your bread or your tank of gasoline or whatever it happens to be, is going to increase. The nominal number that you need to pay to get your stuff is going to increase. You might be getting more in your pay packet, but you're paying more for everything that you need to buy. So it's all relative, and mm-hmm. it's how that kind of balance plays out. Is, you know, how much money people have and how much they have to pay out. The actual raw numbers themselves, perhaps less important, but it's just what proportion of your income are you having to spend on the stuff that you need? Mm-hmm. And certain periods of time in history when that increases rapidly, so the price of bread, the price of milk, the price of, you know, rice and pasta and whatever, you know, the staple dietary requirements that people need, you know, when they start to increase rapidly in price and more rapidly than people's wages, then it tends to cause problems, you know, societal problems and problems with, you know, civil unrest and all that kind of stuff. And you just look at these periods, you know, the period around the First World War, the Second World War, and of course what happened with the oil crisis in the 1970s and leading up to the late 1970s and 1980. None of those periods have been known for financial, political, or economic stability. Mm-hmm. So all I'm sort of suggesting here with this chart is that we're entering a period of equal, you know, unrest, whether, you know, I pray to God it's nothing to do with wars, because we can, don't think anybody wants any kind of conflict or war. But you just look back through history, even beyond 100 years, if you look back through the millennia, through, you know, through the Roman times and through Greek history and through the Mayans and, you know, Aztecs, the Incas, all of these civilizations through history, a lot of their downfall has been to do with, you know, civil unrest brought about by lack of either, you know, money or raw goods and materials, food, mm-hmm. Pressures through lack of food and lack of what people need to live. So, yeah, this chart is just, you know, out there as a warning flag for people that we're going to be entering an era that is likely to last at least a decade and perhaps a couple of decades, where stuff gets uncomfortable. Mm-hmm.
And the other thing, you know, if you looked at this chart inversely, like if you put the left side up at the top, this would kind of show the purchasing power of the dollar continuously falling, right?
Exactly. Yeah,
it's just more dollars having to go into buying the same, or not buying the same goods, but into producing the same goods.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's what I was sort of clumsily trying to explain earlier on. You know, it's mm-hmm. it is just exactly that, and it's nothing particularly clever or particularly complicated. You don't need to be an economist to be able to understand that fairly straightforward point. The next chart, which I was going to show you, I can just get it to come up on the screen. There we go. This is the same PPI chart, just visualized in a slightly different way. So it's exactly the same chart, the same graph going back to the just over 100 years there. And it shows I'm trying to show here the historic nature of what's happening at the moment, because only two previous times going back through 100 years have we had this kind of massive breakout through a horizontal resistance level that has been there for, you know, 10, 20, 30 years. So you build these resistance levels, these horizontal levels where the price kind of stops and the index kind of hesitates for year after year after year. And then you get this surge of inflationary pressures. And it's just like pressure building in a pressure cooker, or, you know, you hold the old saying about holding a beach ball underwater. You know, you can hold it under for so long and then the pressure's released. And this, you know, that's a good way of visualizing what's just happened over the last few months. We've seen the pressure being released and off it goes, whatever the explanation is for the mechanics of how and why that happens. It doesn't really matter here. The fact is that from a technical analysis point of view, it has happened and we have broken out, and that angle of ascent is now steepening and is going to have consequences. That's another way of visualizing the same thing.
Kevin, I think, you know, there can be arguments made that once the shipping delays and you know, the concerns around the virus are sorted out, that these costs could kind of come back down. But, you know, this seems to me to have other downstream effects, where there are other factors that could come in here and keep pushing the prices up that aren't necessarily related to shipping and, you know, inability to work in close quarters, right?
No, I think there's more to it than that, and it's not simply the COVID pandemic that's been causing this. I mean, you just look back at the chart as a chart analyst, and you can see that the chart has been hitting resistance for many, many years before COVID came along, and it was approaching the support line for many, many years before COVID came along. Mm-hmm. So where it's just tested that support line in the last year or two, that was predetermined. It was predestined that for whatever reason, the price chart was going to hit that rising angled red support line that goes all the way back to the 1930s. And, you know, the last time it sort of hit that line was in the 1960s, 1970s, and it tracked along that support line for a while, helping to confirm that the support line existed. And then it accelerated away to the upside in the 1970s and heading towards 1980. Well, the same thing has just happened. We've hit that support line. And a technical chart analyst would have looked at this. Well, I looked at this, you know, a couple of years ago and thought, well, something's coming along. Price is going to hit that line, and I don't know what's going to cause it to break to the upside, but that is the most likely outcome. And, mm-hmm. you know, that's what's happened here. So from a mathematical and scientific point of view, you look at a chart like this and you say, well, it's going to be highly likely to break to the upside, and the odds favor an upside breakout, without necessarily pausing to think why that might happen. Some people might try and pin it on COVID and say, well, it's, you know, it's temporary, it's transitory, it's going to go away. But that's not what the chart is telling us.
And it also looks like once you have an explosive upside move like that, it doesn't really come back down.
No. And on that point about coming back down, so this will tie in with something we're going to just mention later on as well. This is the knock-on effect of all that, of course. This is US inflation numbers. And you look at those periods in history that I was talking about before there, and you can see the numbers there associated with the inflation numbers around the First World War, the Second World War, and the 1970s and 1980s, 24, 20, and 15%. A lot of people think of the late 1970s and 1980s being terrible inflation. Well, it wasn't as bad as the period around the First and Second World War. That line, those peaks have created a very clear resistance line. Some might argue it's only had three touches, so it's not a particularly strong resistance line, and the evidence for it is limited. Well, yeah, it is, but in 100 years of data, it's all we've got to go on. So I'm going to say that that's the resistance line, and we're targeting 11%. So at that 11% level, going up at the angle that we're going up at the moment. And of course, the other thing I have to mention here is, and people are probably screaming at me saying this, is that, yeah, but the inflation numbers aren't measured the same way they were. So year by year, the way that the authorities in the United States and everywhere else in the world, the way they measure inflation numbers is changing. Mm-hmm. Stuff that is in the calculation for inflation in the 1920s and 30s probably doesn't even exist anymore. And it's constantly being replaced with new stuff. And that, I accept, is all going on. And you could take the view that that's being done to manipulate the numbers downwards. And that may very well be the case. Nevertheless, you know, from a pure technical analysis point of view, this is what the chart, if we forget all of that, this is what the chart is telling us. You know, it's telling us where the resistance level is. And that's the evidence that I've got to go on as a sort of a scientist, if you like, you know, with my scientific background, looking for evidence. But yeah, you can't forget the fact that these numbers are manipulated, and the real inflation rate isn't going to be 6.8%. It's going to be 10, 12, 15% if you were to measure it in the same way that we measured it 20, 30 years ago. So right. I accept that argument. That's true. But 11% is where I expect there to be a pause. And it's going to do one of two things there. It's either going to pull back, I think, and form a bullish consolidation just below the resistance line, or it'll break through the resistance line and then come back and back test it from above. I don't think is going to happen. I don't think it's going to hit the 11% level and then just plummet all the way back down to 3, 4, 5% or less. You know, I don't think it's going to go all the way back down to 0 or 1%. I mean, if there's a big deflationary event, something, you know, COVID related or whatever, you can't rule it out. So it's not impossible. It's not impossible for it to go down to 0 or 1 or some very, very low number again. Mm-hmm. But I think it's overall, my feeling is that it's more likely to form a bullish consolidation below the 11% level, or just break through it and come back and back test it from above. And my reason for that goes back to the PPI chart and the fact that that suggests to me this isn't at all transitory and isn't likely to reverse quickly and stay reversed. So any reversal at this 11% level, I would think, would be probably just for a year or 18 months or something like that, whilst an event unfolds. Also, the cyclical nature of certain other markets, which we'll go on to in a little while, also suggests that there could be a pullback into the period around 2024 before a further advance. So this is a roadmap. You know, nothing's set in stone, but just using the evidence that is in front of us, this is, you know, what I'm seeing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's interesting the point you bring up about the change in how we measure CPI. But like you say, this, it's kind of the best we have to be able to go on. But it would be interesting to be able to measure it with a consistent, you know, measuring stick or reference level, right?
Well, they call that gold, I think.
Great point.
which has gone up relentlessly, of course, since we came off the gold standard from $25 to $250 to over $2,000. So, and by the way, I always like to remind people that gold has gone up, I think, by about twice as much as the equities markets have in the last 20 years since I started investing. So if you started investing roughly 20 years ago, then you can't really complain about the performance of gold, because it's outperformed US equities over that period. But you can pick and choose your reference period and make it suit your argument.
Of course, yeah.
The Fed funds rate. Now, again, I'll remind everybody, I'm not an economist. I'm a meteorologist and a scientist by trade. But so I'm not going to sit here and explain in detail what this means in terms of US economics, except that from a mathematical and scientific point of view, it's telling us that something unusual is happening. And that is the key takeaway from this, is that the Fed funds rate told us a while ago, when it broke below the support line here, that something historic was taking place. Mm-hmm. Because the last time it did it, last time it broke below that horizontal support line, was during a period of great instability in the 1970s and the 1980s, which was associated with gold going up. It doubled, and then it doubled again, then it doubled again, then it doubled again, and then it went up some more. So if you think gold can't double and then double again and double again and double again and then go up a bit more, just take a look at this chart and look at the historic events that are unfolding now. Mm. And I'm not one of these people that's going to, you know, gold is going to the moon, it's going to be $10,000 and silver is going to be $150. I'm not in that camp, because I use, you know, I'm a bit sort of conservative when it comes to my predictions, and I need the evidence and I need the breakouts to occur. Mm-hmm. Before I'll start pointing to those sort of upside targets. But having said that, you have to acknowledge that what's happening now is historic. And the last time this historic event happened, gold went up by multiples, and so did silver, of course, and many other things, oil, and goodness knows what else. So, just focus on the fact that something historic is taking place at the moment, and invest accordingly. Plan your investments, take your time. Don't worry about the fact that gold is up $20 or down $20, or that the miners are, down 40% since you took a position or whatever. All of this is, I'm firmly of the view that everything that's going on with the gold and silver junior miners and the GDX and gold and silver itself, and platinum especially as well, and other markets, uranium, are just in the very sort of early stages of something that is going to turn out to be life-changing for those that that see the signs.
So was that, Kevin, was that basically real rates, or that's just the interest rate?
Oh, yeah, sorry, I should explain what the Fed funds rate is. It's the overnight interbank lending rate.
Okay.
So this is the interest rate that's applied between banks in the United States in the overnight lending markets. Mm-hmm. So what it means is if the Fed funds rate is at a reasonable, what you call a historically reasonable level, then there's not a lot to worry about. Mm-hmm. Okay. And I'm making this as simple, explaining this in very simple terms, because you really don't need to be to get into all of the detailed economics of it to sort of understand the what you need to understand from it, which is if it's a historically normal level, no problem. Mm-hmm. If it's historically stretched to the upside, like it was in 1980, and you're somewhere up near 8-10% or more, it's telling you something's wrong. And if it's down below the support level,
lower than it's ever been.
Lower than it's ever been. Well, not quite lower than it's ever been, because if you scroll back to the 1940s and the 1920s, okay, you'll find it was at this level or lower. But that ties in with what we were just saying a moment ago about what went on in the 1940s and the 1920s. Mm-hmm. So the level that it's at now is the lowest it's been at in over 50 years. And in that context, it's historic. And it's, I've got an indicated level there of -7.5%, because there's another downtrending support line there, which may stop the plunge and it may reverse there and break to the upside. And then that opens a whole different can of worms, and the whole Pandora's box then starts to open up there, with rising interbank lending rates and the problems that come with that when you have levels of debt. Anyway, that's a different conversation. But just the takeaway from this chart is that something historic is taking place that doesn't happen more than probably once in each human lifetime, mm-hmm. maybe twice if you're lucky and live long enough. I'm not sure lucky is the right word to use in this context.
Yeah.
And so talking about how all of that sort of is having a knock-on effect, the Bloomberg Commodity Index. And there are various commodity indices that you can look at, and this is just one of them. But they're all telling much the same story. Back in late 2019, early 2020, so what would that be, over 18 months ago now, I drew this chart and spotted the arc pattern that was there, and the fact that we were hitting the bottom of the arc, and there wasn't really much scope to extend the arc or fiddle around with it or make it bigger. So my thesis was that the commodity sector was going to see a move from where it was at the time, somewhere near $60, up to somewhere near where you can see the target, 87 to 93. And I put that chart out on Twitter about 18 months ago, drew the black arrow on there and sat back and just watched it all unfold. It was a classic sort of around the apex move of that sort of symmetrical triangle that you've got there, that's marked out with the red dashed lines, horizontal red line at the bottom and the angled dashed red line coming down from the top left hand corner. So price broke down from that triangle and then it rapidly rose back up through the apex of the triangle, which is the point where the two dashed sort of red lines meet. And then off it went up to the 87 to 93 target. And then it went on up to the next resistance level around about $107. My next prediction was that we would spend a period of time going sideways within that range, sort of 87 to 107. Mm-hmm. And that's so far what we've been doing. We've been trending sideways, and I've got half an eye on the right-hand side of the arc there, which it would be unusual if it wasn't tested at some point. So at the moment, we're just in a consolidation holding phase, waiting for the inevitable upside breakout, I guess, and it's a question of how long we can trend sideways before the upside breakout. Mm-hmm. That's the Bloomberg Commodity Index, and it's what it's telling us here. The takeaway is that we have inflation. You know, no matter how much people have been trying to deny it over the last year and a half, we have inflation in many places, not just in equities, which of course the equities have gone up, led mainly by a small number of mega cap companies, whilst many of the smaller companies in the indices have gone sideways or even down. But not only have they gone up, but commodities. So we're talking about base metals, copper, lumber. You're talking about things like wheat and soybeans and all the staples that people need for life, really, I suppose. So these commodity indexes are made up of a selection of all those kind of things. And they've gone up, as you can see, very, very much over the last 18 months.
And this is again tied back to our PPI index. These are the input, commodities for that index, right?
Yeah, and this broke out and made its move ahead of the PPI breaking out. So, mm-hmm. My sort of tweets over the last 18 months around this particular chart have been saying over and over again that, from a technical analysis point of view, and I know a lot of people poo-poo technical analysis and say it's some kind of voodoo, but from a technical analysis point of view, this is telling us that something is going on that is going to cause more than just transitory inflation, because these costs, as you quite rightly say, get fed into all the downstream products. So you're talking about wheat and soybeans. That what do you need to make bread? What do you need to make? I think you call them potato chips in the United States. Here in the UK, wheat products that snacks and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. All the things that we just take for granted are made with these products that are in these commodity indices. Copper used in a whole range of applications, and so are all the base metals that are in these indices. So it's been telling us that something's been brewing for quite a while now, and I suppose that politicians have been trying to convince us otherwise, convince us that everything's fine, and the band has been playing on the deck of the Titanic, as they say, whilst the iceberg has been looming into view. But mm-hmm. A lot of people just haven't been paying attention.
Kevin, the Bloomberg Commodity Index doesn't include oil, correct?
I think you're right on that. I'd have to double check, because there's about three or four indices that I'm tracking at the moment, and I always forget which. But I think you're right on that. I think it's in the there's an S&P commodity index. There's a number of them. There's a GSCI commodity index, which may well have it in. But of course, oil is another one that, the chart for oil doesn't look too dissimilar to this, of course, having moved up to $70 plus and a little bit of a pullback since, in a very similar fashion. You could overlay the chart of crude oil on here, and over the last 18 months wouldn't look very different.
Yeah. And I was just wondering about that, because, thinking about oil as an input cost on the PPI, that would make sense that it would be even more dramatic as well. But exactly like the next chart that we're going to look at, it's so important to think about the energy component of, how costs are rising all over.
Yeah, and energy is the ultimate input cost. Mm-hmm. You can't do anything without energy, whether it's natural gas or whether it's electricity. Now, this happens to be the chart for UK natural gas futures, traded on the on the open wholesale markets. And so I don't know where to start with this chart. I mean, I started highlighting this chart a few months ago, and I couldn't really believe quite what was happening when it burst out through the previous seasonal highs. You can see how, you know, from year to year and season to season, you get these peaks very often during the colder months of the year, which makes a lot of sense. And the peaks tend to be anywhere between 50 and 100 pounds. The UK natural gas futures, so it'll be traded in British pounds. So that's where you'd expect it to be. That's the range that you'd expect. But goodness me, what's been going on over the last few months is just, it's breathtaking, really. But as it says there, you know, natural gas futures behaving like a meme coin, £8 to £359. I don't know what that is in US dollars or euros, but, you know, in terms of percentage, it's just absolutely crazy. It's that thousands of percent increase in something that is not, we're not talking about, you know, the price of bananas here. You know, you're talking about energy costs, which factored into pretty much everything that's produced. You know, here in the UK, natural gas is used to heat people's homes. The vast majority of homes in the UK are heated with natural gas. So this is going to have a huge impact. It's had a huge impact on me personally, because the utility company that provides me with my gas and electricity has gone bankrupt because they can't absorb these costs. We have an energy price cap in the UK, and the companies are capped as, in terms of how much they can charge customers, and the cap is reviewed every year. And so we started off with many dozens of providers, might even have been hundreds of energy providers in the UK, but certainly dozens. And one by one, they've gone out of business and gone bankrupt and just left a handful standing. And they were the ones that were able to hedge these price movements more effectively. But my company went bankrupt, and so my energy bill has gone up by 100%. Paying something like $150 a month for my gas and electricity, I'm paying nearer $300. I'm quoting in dollars because I suppose most viewers will be more comfortable talking about dollars. But yeah, it's gone up to nearer $300 a month. So 100% rise, which, you know, I can manage, but a lot of people who over recent years have become accustomed to the prices that we've been paying will really struggle with that and have real problems. And it's not just natural gas, it's electricity as well. So, you know, pardon the language there, but seriously, what the hell? Just look at the numbers there. We've gone from a low of £24 per unit. I call it per unit because it's not not my area of expertise, but we've gone way, way up there beyond 400, getting towards 500 pounds per year. These numbers are crazy. I mean, they're just, and it's not just the UK either. You know, after I started posting these on Twitter, I'm getting messages from followers saying, well, this is happening in Denmark, it's happening in France, it's happening in Germany, it's happening right the way across Europe. With the, you know, energy prices going up by hundreds and even thousands of percent. What does it mean? What does this all mean? Well, it all means, I suppose, one thing. And I said when I started posting these charts, you know, it's okay if this is a very short-term spike that reverses to the downside, mm-hmm. and ends up back where it came from within a few weeks or perhaps a 2 or 3 months.
Minus the damage to the utility companies that can't absorb the cost.
Yeah, well, they've gone.
And facing the cap on the other side for what they can charge.
Yeah, the cap on the other side. So, you know, in a few months' time, I don't know exactly when the energy price cap is reviewed, but unless the UK government wants these companies to all go bankrupt, the price cap is going to have to be raised hugely, so that consumers are going to be faced with. And the other problem is that in the UK, people change their service provider from one year to the next, constantly seeking out the cheapest deal. So people will be on a fixed 12-month deal at a low rate that they fixed, you know, 6 months ago or 12 months ago. And when their deal comes to an end, a bit like your mortgage deal on your house, you then have to seek out another, you know, a new provider and a new deal, where a lot of people are going to be pushed into energy poverty through this. I guess, you know, looking at this from a technical chart analysis point of view, I would expect this to come crashing back down. But if that level that you see that I've marked on there, it says previous record seasonal highs, from a technical analysis point of view, that would now act as a support level rather than a resistance level. So my worry, my expectation is that this will come down very rapidly at some point. If it doesn't, all hell will break loose. So my expectation is it will come crashing back down. But if it only comes crashing back down to the previous record seasonal high somewhere on this chart, I don't know, near £70, £60, £70, £80 a unit, then that is going to be a serious problem for a lot of people. It doesn't need to be up at 300 or 400 to be causing huge problems. You know, just the previous record seasonal highs are going to be causing huge, huge problems for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what happens with it and how that situation actually gets resolved, because a lot of that is just, you know, with the gas, that's just, you know, a complete lack of supply coming into the market, right?
Yeah, there's with supply problems. We rely quite heavily, a lot of Europe does, on gas supply from Russia. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of geopolitical stuff going on there at the moment that is feeding into this market and fears around what's going on with politics in that part of the world. So that's having a big impact. But there's probably more to it than just that. It's going to be fascinating to see how this resolves. But I couldn't talk to you today without pointing this out, because it is just such a crazy, crazy chart. Mm-hmm. And I'll carry on posting this chart for followers on Twitter. You know, as we go forward to see what happens. Also looking at inflationary pressures and currency issues, the euro dollar chart's an interesting one, and perhaps not a particularly popular view. But you know, I keep going back to the technical chart analysis and what it's telling us, and we have a well-established arc pattern that's built out here, a basing pattern that's, you know, I talk about these arcs, and it's really just you could also say it's a basing pattern as described by Stan Weinstein's stage analysis, stage one basing pattern, or you could call it a Wyckoff accumulation pattern. You know, these different terminologies and theories, they're all saying the same thing. It just happens that I sort of prefer to show and express them in this arc pattern, because it's visually quite simple to understand. But point here is that the euro dollar, the ratio of the euro to the dollar, has broken out, meaning that the euro has broken a long established downtrend to the upside. So it broke out, and you can see this back testing period since 2020, and we've come back down and we've formed a bullish descending wedge, and bullish descending wedges back testing a breakout level, you know, it's highly likely to move to the upside. Could it break to the downside? Well, yeah, I suppose anything's possible, but from a probability point of view, the probability is that the euro will begin to start showing strength against the dollar, mm-hmm. over the next few years. I'm not going to tell you why, you know, from a political point of view or an economic point of view, I'm not really too worried why the euro would perform better than dollar. One thought that did cross my mind, and I don't tend to think of fundamentals very much, but the rate of inflation is already higher in the US than it is in Europe, mm-hmm. and interest rates are already... So interest rates in the United States are already higher than they are in the Eurozone. So I suppose this is me trying to move out of my comfort zone here a little bit. There is more room for inflation and measures to control inflation in the Eurozone than there is in the United States. We've already got higher inflation and higher interest rates in the United States than we have in the EU. So that could be viewed, you know, you could view that as being something that counts in favor of the euro, mm-hmm. I guess. maybe, perhaps. But as I say, I'm a technical analyst, so I'll sit back and wait and see what sort of political stories come out to justify the reason why the euro is performing better than the dollar going forward, which is what I would expect.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how this arc actually ends up playing out.
And don't forget, the euro makes up something north of 50 or 60%, I think, of the dollar index. Probably, is it 60% or more? I forget now. But the largest component of the dollar index is the euro.
Yeah.
With the British pound and the yen, I think it is, making up other significant. I think the British pound is about 11% of the dollar index, if my memory serves me. So talking about the US dollar, this is the dollar index itself, the DXY. And here you can see how, a couple of things I wanted to point out here. The cyclical nature of the dollar index, you get these basing patterns, then topping patterns. Arc 1 is a base, arc 2 is a top, arc 3 is a base, and arc 4 is, in theory, a top, although it's extended and extended and extended. But we find ourselves in a bearish rising wedge with the dollar index at the moment. You can see the inset on the top right of this chart, which is the zoomed in view of where that black arrow is pointing to. So you can see that we're in a bearish rising wedge challenging the top of the dome. The other point I wanted to make on this chart is how the view that gold doesn't go up when the dollar index goes up. Well, there are three examples here highlighted in orange where gold has gone up substantially whilst the dollar index has also gone up. Reasons for this are manyfold, I guess. There are other things in play with the gold price, not just the dollar index. So I'm thinking about yields and real yields, for example, and what's going on with inflation. And my friend and colleague Patrick Karim will talk to you about the inflation adjusted dollar index, because the dollar index itself is arbitrary. You need to set it into the context of inflation. So the dollar index isn't immune to inflation. Inflation is going on around the dollar index. So if the dollar index is going up less than the rate of inflation, then what that in simple terms means is that other stuff that constitutes that inflation number is rising more quickly than the dollar index. So if you have an inflation figure of 10%, but the US dollar index has moved from 96 to 100, that means the US dollar index has gone up, you know, something like 4%, whilst real, you know, inflation, everything out there in the real world, has gone up 10%.
Right.
So in other words, stuff has gone up 6% more than the US dollar index has. And when you say stuff, you don't just have to talk about loaves of bread and pints of milk, or quarts of milk, or litres of milk, or whatever your unit. You can also talk about gold and silver and platinum and commodities. So stuff in the world, and of course gold is the ultimate barometer for inflation. There, and it does its thing measuring the decreasing purchasing power of the dollar or your chosen fiat currency. So the rate at which your fiat currency is depreciating, in other words, the rate of inflation, is going to directly be reflected in gold price, and the US dollar index can rise quite happily. You know, it can rise away, it can go up 10%, but if real world inflation is 20%, you can probably expect gold to outperform anyway, regardless of what the dollar index is doing. Don't forget that, because that's an important point to remember if, as I believe, we're moving into a more sustained inflationary environment.
Yeah, and it's interesting again to think about the you know, real barometer that we need to be looking at some of these charts with.
Yeah. I mean, you can choose any barometer. You know, you can choose a price of a bunch of bananas, or you can choose the price of your favorite candy bar, or whatever. You know, price of a car or the price of a house. What you'll find if you chart it on a chart, if you chart the price, is that they go through periods where they increase in price rapidly. So the price of a house might go up rapidly, but the price of a car isn't. And then 6 months later, the price of a car is going up rapidly, but the price of a house isn't. So you find that everything's kind of going up, but at different points in time. There's a mismatch between gold going up and oil going up, or cryptos going up and gold going up. But one thing that's universal is that everything is going up inexorably because the purchasing power of your fiat currency is going down. And that's clearly why equities just trend up and up and up, even if the SPX or the Dow Jones or whatever was to fall by 50% next week. When you zoom out and look at the chart in its full glory, in its full context, that would be a little blip because a few years down the line, 3-4 years down the line, it'll have made up that 50% and then some. And you can see examples of that over and over again if you go back through the last 50 plus years on the Dow Jones. And use a quarterly chart instead of using a weekly chart. Look at a quarterly chart, and that puts everything into real context, because a lot of these movements, if you put them on quarterly charts or even yearly charts where you're looking at yearly candles, these price movements are just completely irrelevant. You can't even see them. If you put gold onto a quarterly chart, the scary plunge in 2008 it's not even visible. You can barely see it. So it's all about context. Here we have the gold chart, and you can see the gold, number of things here on this chart. And this was an attempt to sort of simplify things again, which I quite like doing a lot of the time, and just focus on the 12-month and the 36-month moving average. If you want a very simple indication of when to enter and when to exit the trade with gold, get in when the 12-month moving average crosses over the 36-month moving average, and when it crosses back down, take your money and put it into something else. You can see this whole basing period since 2012, 2013, where these moving averages crossed over. You would have been chopped around quite a lot if you're trying to trade gold. But if you just keep out of the trade, except when the moving averages cross over, you get chopped around a lot less. Mm-hmm. And it's a simple fact that buy and hold pretty much always outperforms any other trading strategy. If you can buy and hold for several years, then that will, if you're day trading and you're trying to trade in and trade out, you look at all the different trading strategies for doing that. I've not seen one yet that just beats the simple buy and hold, and you enter the trade when you get your solid buy signal, whether that's a horizontal breakout of a resistance line or whether it's a moving average cross like this one. Mm-hmm. The other thing to notice on here, of course, is the wedge that's formed on the right-hand side of the gold chart. A bit like the wedge that formed in 2011, 12, 13, which broke to the downside. But for all the reasons that we've just discussed, my expectation is for an upside break here, not a downside break.
It's interesting, looking at this simplified chart of when the 12 and 36 month averages cross. It's awesome to be able to, like you say, just simplify it to that point of there's your buy signal, there's your sell signal.
Yeah, there are a lot of ways of determining a buy point and an exit point, an entry and an exit. Mm-hmm. But the more clever you get with it, the more buy and sell signals you get. Mm-hmm. And the more false alarms you get. So it's always a balance between, you'll notice on this chart here, it gave the exit signal somewhere around about $1,600. So you'd have missed out on the top $400, which you wouldn't have done if you just exited when it crossed down below the 12-month moving average, when price crossed below the 12-month moving average. But you'll notice it crossed below the 12-month moving average, then it went above it, then it came below it, then it went above it, then it came below it. So you get chopped around, and in the process of that getting chopped around, you're decaying your capital the whole time. So, getting in at 280 and exiting at 1550 over a sort of 10, 11, 12-year period is pretty damn good. You're making a really good return there when you work out your annual rate of return. That's massively impressive and way better than you get from any investment fund, I'm quite sure. Mm-hmm. or hedge fund or whatever. Looking at gold in terms of its cyclical behavior, You can't really go back before the period in the 1970s where the Bretton Woods Agreement was thrown out the window and the US came off the gold standard. So trying to go back before that is you can't do it. But since then, gold has settled into and formed and developed a very cyclical pattern of behavior in the every 8 years. And within that 8 years, you get embedded 4 year cycles. But we're focusing here on the 8 year cycle. And you can see how every 8 years, there's a notable low point in the price of gold. And cycles are measured from low to low, not from high to high, by the way. So the high point of the cycle can occur early in its cycle or it can occur late in its cycle. You can see in the cycle from approximately 77 to 85 or thereabouts, you can see that the cyclical high occurred to the left of the center of that cycle. So it was a left translated cycle. The following one was also left translated with the peak occurring sometime in the late 1980s. And then there was a steady decline into that cyclical low whenever it was in the early 1990s there. And then again, the peak in the cycle following that was left translated, and then it declined steadily down towards 2000, 2001. And then the cycle after that was very much right translated, because it wasn't until we were right on top of the 8 year cycle low in 2008 that the price plummeted. So in 2007, I think it was late 2007, the price plunged and fell from over $1,000 to less than $700, losing over 30% in a very short space of time. And that put in the 8 year cycle low in a very right translated cycle. And price took off and formed a left translated cycle into 2011. So you can see how the process has continued with the 8 year cycle low in 2016. And so the point of this chart is to remind everybody that the next 8 year cycle low is due in 2024. What form that takes and how it looks is remains to be seen, but we expect a cyclical low in 2024. The question for me has always been, are we trending down now? Did we turn down in August of last year? And is this us going down and down and down into 2024? Or are we going to see a breakout, a move up, which would probably be quite a rapid move up, and see new highs? Are we going to do that and then see a little bit of a dip down into 2024 before moving steadily higher again? That's my that's always been my base case, my kind of expected scenario, is in fact that we do see a breakout before 2024, a significant move to the upside, and then we come down into a 2024 low point, which would probably coincide somewhere with the US election cycle. And when people ask me, why do we get these 4 and 8 year cycles and 16 year cycles, the only way I can describe it, not being an economist again, is that it's tied in with the 4 year US election cycle. It makes some kind of sense, the cyclical nature of politics in the United States. That's the only explanation I've come up with up to this point. But a lot of the markets do display 4 year cycles, including Bitcoin. And the Bitcoin, the history of Bitcoin is short. I mean, gold, you know, we were just looking at price charts there going back to the 1970s. This only goes back to 2011. And the first cycle was disrupted and broken and non-representative anyway, because whenever an asset is born, it has to find its level. It has to find its natural balance and its natural equilibrium. And it took Bitcoin a while to do that, and it burst upwards into this arc number one. So arc number one is incomplete. It doesn't have a left-hand side, but price just confirmed the right-hand side of its arc pattern in arc number one. And that was the first four-year cycle. The next four-year cycle followed, and arc number two was complete. We're in arc number three now. And there's a lot of stuff going around about, you know, cycle extension and cycles becoming longer and all that kind of stuff. Well, there is some evidence to support that, I suppose, but looking at the low points in Bitcoin's cycles. We can't really say that with any confidence until we get the next cyclical low. Mm-hmm. And the theoretical move here to the upside, we need to see a breakout above the previous all-time highs to set in stone any targets that are above 100,000, for example. But that is the roadmap that we're considering, or that I'm considering and have been following for quite some time now. That's circles us all right the way back to where we started, really, with inflation and the fact that stuff just keeps going up and up and up, and the same has happened with Bitcoin. Each cyclical low is higher than the previous cyclical low because there's more money around. Mm-hmm. And it finds its way into assets, whether it's cryptos or gold or commodities or whatever it is, and so these will just continue marching upwards.
I like looking at these cyclical charts, Kevin, because it's interesting to take a step back and to see kind of this 4 and 8 year cycle with gold or Bitcoin here. It just gives you a completely different perspective on how these arcs really overlay on the 4 and 8 year cycle, like you say.
Yeah, and it just helps. Yeah. You know, then none of this technical analysis, I've got to say this, none of it is set in stone. So, you know, it's like a weather forecast. I'm a meteorologist. You know, you produce a weather forecast, and if you're forecasting a hurricane in the United States and the hurricane's going to hit in 10 days' time, you'd be pretty foolish to listen to that weather forecast and not listen to an update the next day, and then listen to an update the day after that, and an update the day after that. Ask yourself, why are you listening to the update if you've been given the forecast? Well, it's because the whole time, as time progresses, you're getting new evidence coming in. It doesn't mean that the first weather forecast was wrong. What it means is that the scientists are taking all of the latest evidence into account and taking into account all of the variables and everything that's changing. And you cannot ignore reality with a weather forecast, you know, so you have to continually update and continually adjust your data. And that's exactly the same when you're forecasting the price of Bitcoin, forecasting the price of gold, anything else. It doesn't mean that you're doing something wrong just because you have to adjust your roadmap and adjust your forecast. It means that you're being realistic and you're not being, you know, obstinate and pig-headed and sticking with your incorrect prediction. You have to constantly factor in all of the variables.
Mm-hmm. Excellent, Kevin. Well, I think that wraps it up pretty well there. We've gone through some interesting charts here today, and I appreciate your time as always. Of course, you post all that stuff on Twitter at Northstar Charts, and of course your guys' website, you and Patrick, northstarbadcharts.com. You have all kinds of charts there, and then you have a premium service there as well, right?
Yeah, we've got nearly 2,000 charts on there for regular members now, with regular podcasts and guest interviews, all for a pretty low price. So the website's there. Anyone wants to take a look, just go along there, take a look. And there's a premium service for those that are more serious about their investing as well. So please do come along and have a look.
Excellent, Kev. Thanks so much for your time today.
Cheers, Tom. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.